various things, I think maybe then politics, or at least it's a difficult problem. This last year, as we know, there was the disruption became kind of a standard outdoor sport. What with raiding church offices and seizing buildings and immolating draft files and so on. These and these kind of disruptions, of course, particularly focusing on the campuses, became a very common part of the American scene. In effect, the disruption has become sort of the descendant of the demonstration. And I'd like to sort of talk about how the disruption sort of developed out of the demonstration. But I'd also like to suggest that the disruption, however, quote, criminal in the eyes of the law and order people, and however, quote, activist and political, you know, the thing to do to be really political in the minds of the exponents, are probably neither so dangerous a threat to law and order as the boys in blue would like to fantasize, or all that political in the sense of really being a method by which we can create social change. The overwhelming credit line for violence, of course, still goes to the police rather than to the disruptors. The militants at Cornell may carry out the guns in symbolic gesture of defiance, you know, kind of look, Ma, guerrilla warrior, you know, I got a kick out of all those little sons of the black middle class coming out playing guerrilla warrior. But of course, it is in Berkeley that the police really used the gun and really killed people. The militants like to talk about using all force necessary, but most of the blood in the streets is still their own. Now, the difficulty in sorting out responsibility for violence, of course, lies in the fact that the disruption is really a drama which is designed to evoke violence. It's designed to evoke a kind of violent punitive response precisely in order to sort of strip off the mask of the establishment and show, sort of reveal the pig, you see. That's what the disruption is all about. It's a scenario designed to reveal the pig, reveal the violence of the establishment in all of its nakedness. And therefore, of course, the disruptor creates this scenario to reveal the pig, but this means, of course, that he also takes the violence of the pig upon himself. He is the one that ends up with the smashed head, and then as a kind of irony, he gets blamed for his own smashed head, of course, because who caused it? Well, you did. So that gets a little hard to cut after a while. So in other words, the violence obviously is coming primarily from the law and order side, and this the disruption is really an attempt to evoke this revelation of the violence, but this means that the violence is also, the disruptor takes the violence upon himself primarily. But also I would say that the disruption is not so political as the advocates believe. In other words, I doubt very much if it's really a method of intervening in any order of cause and effect by which real decisions are made or power exercised in society. In this sense, I would question whether it is really, you know, a kind of new form of politics. Now, the disruption, as I suggested, stands in a kind of lineal descent from the demonstration. And the demonstration and the disruption and so on all represent a search in contemporary American society for a method of direct action, direct sort of grassroots democratic action by which, you know, quote, the people can exert political influence directly. Now, the demand for this kind of action obviously arose because people felt powerless to intervene within the workings of the system itself. In other words, they developed this myth that you couldn't do anything within the political system. The political system was seen as a closed circle, perpetuating its own presuppositions. And so to work within it would be to be caught within its own presuppositions, to be compromised, to be co-opted, and so on. So they developed this search for some way of of action outside the system, and from some ground outside the system, from some ground which was freed from the presuppositions of the, quote, system. And, of course, the whole demand for this is evidence of a loss of faith in the system itself, a loss of faith in the potential of the system to be a vehicle for social change. And then, of course, kind of hovering around in this analysis is a kind of anti-institutional thing which really suspects that no systems can be a vehicle for social change. However, the stance of the demonstrator or the protester, of course, was always an ambiguous one, because he moved outside the system, and yet at the same time he was always trying to influence the system outside it, influence it but outside it and against it. The demonstration was designed to create a public drama to air a grievance. Now, I'd like to start out by analyzing the way in which this kind of drama was used in the civil rights movement, and then see how we've moved from there. In its original use in the civil rights movement, it seems to me that the demonstration was a rather carefully staged show in which it was absolutely necessary for the protester to exhibit himself as a model of respectability and discipline. And this was evidenced by the fact that the demonstrators always had to be clean, they had to be neat, they had to have white shirts and ties, you know, they had to look like law-abiding citizens. There was a great deal of preparatory work in which they engaged in workshops so that they would not react violently and so on. There was a great deal of work done in order that the protester would exhibit himself as a model of respectability and discipline. Now, this the reason for this is that he wanted to set up a model of himself which would contrast with the obscenity and the illegitimate violence of the local bullies. In other words, the demonstration was intended to flash a kind of image across the nation of the good guys who were fighting for justice being smashed down by the local cracker establishment. You see, that was intended to flash that kind of image across the nation. And once that image was sort of communicated and all the good people across the nation were saying, outrage, you know, American justice outrage, then that represented a kind of a break in the solid front of the local establishment by which the demonstrators would sort of get in. So once they sort of communicated that message that they were the good guys and the rednecks were beating them down, and in that sort of hiatus that was opened up, at that moment, the leaders of the demonstration would immediately try to move in to the negotiating table. And it was at the negotiating table that the concrete changes were to be made. And so the demonstration, as it operated, let's say, in Martin Luther King's era, had a kind of clear tactic, which I think did work within certain prescribed limits and situations. You moved out to demonstrate, but in order to move back in, to create a break, and then to move back in on a new level where you could negotiate the changes. And that's where the changes were to be made, you see. Its dramatic image was not designed to alienate, but rather to appeal to the uncommitted middle. I think that's a very important point to keep in mind. In other words, it developed a style which was not intended to alienate the great mass of uncommitted Americans, but rather intended to appeal to them and to give all of the good sort of armchair liberals around the nation a satisfying sense of being on the right side by almost the most minimal commitment. I mean, if you sent your little dollar to CORE, or if you came out and marched around a little bit, almost any evidence of supporting the group could give you a satisfying sense of sort of being with the good guys. And this was rather consciously developed, you see, that the demonstration was therapeutic, you might say, toward the great mass of uncommitted Americans. It was confrontationalist toward the extreme right, but it was therapeutic toward the American mainstream. It appealed to their goodwill. It tried to give an image of themselves which would appeal to them and allow them to identify with the demonstrators and to give them a sense of being meritorious at very slight risk to themselves. Now, this earlier stage of outdoor sports broke down for several reasons. First of all, I suppose, because the results, even with legislation, proved too slow, and so people began to get frustrated. Expectations of quick success were raised and then frustrated. Then, too, a kind of psychology set in among those who are really the hardcore demonstrators, the people who are really out there fighting all the time. They began to get kind of mad at giving these sort of easy merit badges to the people who are just sending the dollar and the people who are just, you know, the weekend demonstrator and so forth. They began to get sort of angry at giving these merit badges to these people who were much less committed. And so they began to break down the therapeutic thing that was going on, and instead thirst to confront the liberal and to strip off his mask and to reveal him as a hypocrite, you know, which in some kind of moral sense was perfectly true. But it also broke down the whole kind of therapeutic thing, which the previous style was doing, perhaps unconsciously. So the demonstration gradually changed its style from that of convert winning of the great mass of middle class Americans to an expose of the liberal as a hypocrite and an attempt to create a crisis by which you would distinguish those who are really committed from those who are just the weekend demonstrators and the dollar senders.
In retrospect, was this a wise move?
Well, that's what I'm going to ask, yeah. Okay. The word white liberal then became the new dirty word. Instead of being the ally, you see, which Martin Luther King always reached out to this great alliance of goodwill, the white liberal now becomes the somehow the worst enemy, you know, almost even worse than the cracker. And radicalization set in. And radicalization once begun, of course, is insatiable because no white can be radical enough to be black. That's a simple fact, you see. Epidermis is destiny, you might say. So the demonstration, you see, gradually changed its style. It turned against the people it was originally trying to appeal to. It changed its cultural style from the attempt to look very neat and law-abiding to the attempt to look very unlaw-abiding, scruffy, obscene, you see, and so on. And out of that gradually evolved the disruption. Now, the disruption, however, is also a scenario. It's also a media event. It is designed, however, as a different kind of sociodrama. Instead of appealing therapeutically to the uncommitted, it is designed to sort of unmask them and to reveal them as the pigs or the devils and to bring them in their plain and naked state before the video eye of the American collective consciousness. This is, of course, exactly what happened in Chicago. Those policemen were stripped and revealed, you see, as the pigs. And all the good Americans decided that they liked the pigs better than the scruffy demonstrators, which was, you know, kind of a shock. Now, as I said, the disruption is confrontationalist. It's attempted to strip off the mask of the liberal to show him as basically violent and so on. In the process, it also tries, of course, to get inside the American consciousness and kind of blow its collective mind, if you might use a drug term. I mean, it's really a sort of a social attempt to blow the socially conditioned mind and to reveal what is really there, you know, the violent America underneath the force of the surface of law and order. So it is, in a real sense, an apocalypse. The word apocalypse means an unveiling, where you take off the surface of things, of apparent law and order, and you show the devils that are underneath that surface. Now, this unveiling, or apocalypse, is created really, first of all, through the experience of the disruption itself. In other words, the disruption is designed to create a provocation, which will then result in a kind of massive overreaction on the part of the law and order forces. They will come rushing in there and just sort of create havoc. And then the people who are in that, of course, become radicalized. But the people who are kind of standing around watching this, you know, their friends being dragged out with the blood dripping down their head and so forth, this radicalizes them. You see, the uncertain liberal who were standing out in the Harvard courtyard, not sure what side to stand on, when they saw that happen, you know, they were radicalized. They leapt over into a sort of leftist solidarity with the true believers that they would not have taken if they were just left to think this thing out for themselves. So first of all, you have this experience of radicalization created through provoking an overreacted violent response. And then this experience, of course, is intended to sort of go out through the TV media and radicalize everybody else who sees it. And this is a very powerful kind of thing, which can't be underestimated at all. Even when you figure out the rules of the game, it still has a tremendous amount of power. Now, this kind of tactic, of course, is usually condemned on the grounds that it is divisive. But this is not exactly a way of getting to the dividers, because that's exactly what they're trying to do. You know, in other words, the whole point of the disruption is to polarize. I mean, it's kind of like Last Judgment. You attempt to, you know, kind of set ultimately apart the sheep from the goats. You try to sort of separate out those who are really committed to the revolution from those who are really, no matter what their liberal ideas may be, they're really over there on the side of the poison gas boys, and so on. So it's really precisely an attempt to be divisive, to polarize, to sort of separate out the righteous from the unrighteous. In other words, there's a real kind of theological thing operating here. Those who are separated out, you see, form sort of the remnant or the gathered church of the elect or something. And if their numbers may be small, okay, it's better to know who really are the elect than to be compromised by having any impure people mixing up in your group and so on. In other words, you have this kind of theological, really, dynamic of the separating out, the Last Judgment, separating out of the elect from the unelect, a kind of purism. Now, I think we have to realize that this kind of dynamic operates sociologically to some extent apart from the personal attitudes of the individuals in it. In other words, the individuals in it, I mean, if talked to individually, might have very kind of modest views about their righteousness and so forth. But the social tactic itself tends to radicalize people and to sort of still and silence their more nuanced and ambiguous views, and to force them to kind of stifle those feelings that things are a little bit more colored and not so black and white. The dynamic pulls them into a kind of acceptance of a either-or, quite apart from perhaps their more modest individual views. And I see this operating very much in people in radical movements. It becomes very hard. I mean, pretty soon people can no longer ask any kinds of questions because that becomes very socially acceptable. I mean, that means that you're a doubter, you're not really a believer, and so forth. And so there's a very powerful sociological force dynamic operating here, which tends to commit people to a black and white position, even though individually they may recognize a more nuanced position. In other words, there's a very powerful need to be morally consistent, you see, and to feel a kind of total commitment, a kind of total decision. There's something very attractive about being willing to put your life totally on the line. You know, are you willing to put your life totally on the line? And people who begin to think about that, you know, and then they begin to feel very morally inconsistent because they don't feel their life is totally on the line. So the next thing you know, they are soaking themselves in gasoline and burning themselves up in front of the Pentagon or something. So, I mean, this kind of quest for total commitment tends to pull people over into actions in order to achieve a sense of feeling feeling morally consistent. And this, of course, partly is a result, I think, of the fact that other social institutions like voting and like going to church no longer give you that sense of being morally consistent that you might have had before. You're no longer sure that you're a good citizen because you voted, maybe you shouldn't have voted, you know, in the last election, or you're no longer sure that you're morally consistent by going to church, maybe you ought to stay out of that church and so forth. So a lot of the institutions by which people expressed commitment in the past now appear so ambiguous and tainted, you know, that there's a great attractiveness for some other group that can give you that feeling of being morally consistent. Now, this I'm not trying to, you know, just simply denigrate the radicals at all, but rather to examine the latent suicidal tendencies which are involved in this type of action, because I really believe that however misguided their actions, basically their critique is the most important thing that we can have in our society. And if this critique does not get across, we may really have had it in this country. So I'm very concerned that their critique get across, and precisely because I'm concerned that their critique get across, you know, I have to kind of be for them in a different way than they would like me or other people to be for them. First of all, I have to criticize the idea that they have a new politics. Their idea that grabbing a building or burning a file is really a significant political action over against the establishment. I mean, it's obvious every time somebody burns a file, in the very same article by which this is reported, the draft office quickly reports that they have a duplicate file, and this file burning will not slow down their operation at all, but they will be right back in business the next Monday morning. And this is always said, you see. And every time you seize a building, you get thrown out with a little bit more violence and so on. So, it doesn't seem like they're making a big dent from that point of view. I think they do challenge the establishment in a significant way, but one which is different from, I don't quite know how to put this, one which is not the same thing as sort of intervention in political decision making, but rather the challenge that they give and which evokes such an overreaction on the part of the establishment is really contained in the kind of media event that they're putting out. You see that they're putting out a kind of apocalypse, a kind of communication thing of radical confrontation, and this is what throws the establishment back on them, quite above and beyond the real practical threat which they actually pose to the establishment. In other words, their power lies in the realm of symbol and liturgical gesture. And there's nothing wrong with symbol and liturgical gesture if you don't sort of mix it up with power plays. Now, it seems to me that this confusion of liturgy with power plays is particularly congenial to Roman Catholics because they tend to confuse liturgy with life anyway. So it doesn't surprise me that there's just a tremendous amount of Catholics being attracted into this kind of self-immolation at the present time. In other words, the confusion here involves a kind of conflating of symbol with action in a way that tends to, I think, tends to sort of undo the function of either the symbol or the or political action. It seems to me that we should distinguish liturgy from life by saying that liturgy is not the high point of experience or the source of life, or not the source or the high point of experiencing that which is symbolized, but rather the liturgy is a kind of contra-environment. This is a phrase I think that's used by McLuhan. It's a kind of a contra-environment by which we step outside the arena of action in order to reveal and discern its underlying meaning. In other words, it's a cool medium rather than a hot medium. And it seems to me very bad things happen when communication events become sort of conflated with effective politics. This is bad, first of all, because it doesn't do that job. And so it sets up expectations which are then frustrated and which get people very angry and bitter, because when you burn that draft file, you know, the government didn't fall and so on, and people get very frustrated because they load all kinds of expectation into these actions which they're not going to actually affect. Now, the second problem with discerning the real function of communications and symbols and so forth is that these actions then tend to become mediums for acting out all kinds of other subliminal urges which are operating below the consciousness and which then tend to subvert our consciously stated aims. And this, I think, is very evident in most of these kind of actions. In other words, when my Catholic friends declare that they want to confront the church with its racism, and they do this by rushing in the sanctuary and knocking down the Monsignor, I suspect that there are other problems operating back there, you know, besides, because that's a very ineffective way to confront the church with its racism. I mean, you know, to knock the Monsignor down at the altar. So, I mean, I think there's these other things operating here, the desire to, you know, the adolescent desire to kill the father, in the black community and among the young radicals, I think there's a tremendous kind of urge to display your sexual potency, which is symbolized by the demand to pick up the gun. I mean, quite often this is made quite explicit among the young blacks when they say something like, we have to recover our manhood, you know, pick up the gun. And of course, the gun is such an obvious phallic symbol and so on. So I think you get this kind of thing being mixed up with what you claim to be your stated intentions. Of course, I think there's a very strong fascination with self-destruction, suicide, and so on, which is also operating here, and so on. So the effort to communicate serious problems becomes subverted because you're really acting out all kinds of other issues, which both confuse your own mind and, of course, completely confuse the rest of the people in the society that are looking at this thing, you know, and who quite naturally do not see at all that you're trying to confront the church with this racism, but rather all they see is that you've knocked down the Monsignor and that's a horrible desecration of the church and so forth. In other words, they see what you've done and they react in a, you know, quite logically, absolutely the opposite way in which presumably you want them to act. And I suspect that, you know, that's not accidental, you know, that you have created various kinds of scenarios that are primarily designed to act out your own self-righteousness and are not really at all designed to communicate the problem to people who are outside your bag. Now, I'm very concerned about this because, as I said, I'm concerned to get this message across, and I see these people using all these things which are very ineffective and which in fact are creating a very bad reaction in precisely the opposite direction, and I think that is extremely dangerous. In other words, I happen to think that the daddies of this society have very bad personality problems. The daddies of this society with their fortress of missiles and their poison gas and all of their factories that are making diseases, you know, all this kind of stuff. I mean, and their obsessions with dominating the rest of the people around the world and their obsessions with law and order at home. These daddies have a very bad personality problem. And I really don't like to see these young kids pushing these daddies in this way because I don't trust that daddy that much. See, I think that daddy has very bad problems. And if you keep sort of kicking him in the shins and saying, you know, why don't you be better, you know? I mean, what you're kicking the daddy in the shins and at the same time demanding that he be a good daddy, which is a very childish kind of attitude. Pretty soon, that daddy is going to get less and less vulnerable to you. He's going to get less and less, his feelings of indulgence toward you as a child and so forth will dry up. And when the concentration camps come and all those kiddies are in the behind the barbed wire and they cry out to the daddies, you know, don't you love us anymore, you know, the daddies will say, go to hell, you know. I mean, so I think this is a kind of childish relationship of kicking the daddy in the shins and yet at the same time expecting him to be indulgent. And I'm not sure that the daddy can bear that kind of pressing. I suspect that we have a lot of sleeping dogs of fascism in this society, which the radicals are waking up. And anybody that knows a little history knows, of course, a tremendous parallel between what's going on now and the late 20s and early 30s in Germany, where you had simultaneously the young radicals and the fascists and operating symbiotically to ultimately bring in the right wing. And I don't think this is an impossibility at our society at all. I mean, we got Nixon out of the last round of radical action. Next time around, we could get a better looking Wallace. Not Wallace, but a better looking Wallace. And we've got Reagan in California and so on. So I think the sleeping dogs of fascism are there. They're being wakened up. I don't trust the indulgence of the daddy to keep pressing him in that way. So I think we better start rethinking this whole thing. First of all, I think we better start rethinking the whole decision that was made when the demonstration was left, when the carefully designed tactics of the demonstration were deserted. I think we have to get back to the original aims of the demonstration, which was to be therapeutic rather than confrontationalist toward the broad mainstream of American society. That means that the radicals are going to have to give up their demand for self-righteousness. They're going to have to unhook their activism from scenarios of moral justification and try to construct scenarios which are not simply means of justifying themselves, but rather are really designed to communicate to other people who do not share their position.
Isn't it too late? Hasn't the damage been done? Hasn't the middle been done?
Well, I mean,
middle class been committed?
Well, I mean, it's never too late as long as you're still alive, you know. I mean, you can... there's
the
always...
It's much more difficult now than it was...
I think it's more difficult, but I think there's still a lot of indulgence left. I think if you really rethought this thing now, you could change it, because I don't think it's too late.
I think it's been sorely tested.
Oh, yeah, I think it's very, very sorely tested. Very sorely tested, but I think there's just still an awful lot of miraculously surviving goodwill.
Now, we must not despair.
Yeah, I think there's just a miraculous amount that has survived a basic goodwill.
Are you saying that you want the radical movement to behave nicely?
I'm saying that the radical movement better get out of its bag of trying to always do things to prove how good they are and start trying to do things that are really designed to communicate to other people.
Well, I'm not talking about the draft office breaking and stuff, but give an example of an action that would positively communicate this, that wouldn't alienate.
Well, I mean, I think that we better use the sort of ordinary media a great deal. I mean, I think that publishing the faces of all the boys in Vietnam that died in 1 week in Life magazine probably got across to the great mass of Americans that a lot of, you know, nice kids were dying without, you know, fucking things up with any kind of image of scruffy demonstrators or anything like this. I mean, I think we better just use the ordinary media of communication and TV and so forth to get across good stories of what's going on. First of all, I mean, I think that's the most powerful medium. And to use it in a pretty straight way communicates much more at this point. Then I think I don't know how far you can take it, but I think that the kind of thing that Abby Hoffman and so forth was doing, if you could relieve it of some of its... Oh yeah, but he has a basically good idea, even though he's terribly obsessed with obscenity and so on, which is a poor which is not useful, I think. But I mean, for example, he was creating all kinds of scenarios which were not illegal at all, but which were really designed to be kind of social dramas to reveal what things were. I mean, I think his great thing of exercising the Pentagon was great. I wish that had been given much more coverage, because that was just a beautiful thing.
But this, I think that alienates vast numbers of people. I don't think most people find that either greater.
That's very special language.
It's really hard if you're trying to you're gonna confront. I think you get really into trouble if you start really getting too worried about alienation, because what can you do that won't alienate? Martin Luther King alienated.
Yeah, he alienated. He confronted the far right. He confronted the cracker. But he tried to confront it in a way that would appeal as broadly as possible to the middle. He was much more savvy in that way. I don't think you can get away from any confrontation, but I think you better pick out who are really the enemies and not spend your time trying to destroy the guy who is in the radical organization 1 inch to the right of you, which is exactly what's going on right now. You better, you know, concentrate on the people who are really over there doing the things instead of destroying each other. You better be willing to get together a lot more liberal coalitions and
well,
so
you
on.
Just gave,
I mean, I don't.
A perfect illustration of what one can do that will not alienate. And I remind you of that again. I thought the Life magazine photograph is an excellent example of what can be done that will not alienate. This is an answer to your question, Julie.
Because that thing was just a straight, you know, revelation of what was going on without being mixed up with any sort of contra image of grass smoking protesters or anything that you know, which bothers people's minds.
I think the point is good if you have to distinguish about alienating who. If you're alienating the extreme right, that maybe, or confronting, that's one thing. But if you're alienating the entire middle class, the people in between, that's something far different, and that's happening.
See, now this bothered me very much in the last election because it became almost a kind of left-wing dogma that Humphrey was just as bad as Wallace and McCarthy was just as bad as Humphrey. You see, everybody became sort of just as bad, and he became much more interested in showing how contemptuous you were of the McCarthy kids than you were in fighting Wallace, you see.